for my people in the front, in the nosebleed section. This is for the
hello and good evening, our fellow brappy boys and girls. This is your weekly motorcycling podcast about life, the universe, and everything. Welcome to Brap Talk. I am your host, Shaheen Alvandi, and the beautiful, handsome Quentin Wilson sitting across from me. Q, how are you doing?
Howdy. I'm doing good.
Yeah. What's in your world? What's new?
Not a terrible amount, other than it seems like the past couple of podcasts have been like building up to go to Austin.
I know.
So that's
excited.
Like, I leave on Monday. Looking forward to that greatly.
It is Thursday night, so you've got a Friday and a Saturday and a Sunday ahead of you.
Yeah.
What does a fly-in mechanic do to get ready to deal with a big venue like Austin?
There's really not much I can
do.
You just
show up?
I talked to the team manager today, just to kind of a quick, hey, this is how we're doing the thing. Because this is a weird one. Normally, you have a cadence to a Moto America weekend that's always the same.
Right.
Or close to the same. This being glommed onto Moto GP is weird. So we were like, hey, we're going to do this. We're only racing 2 days instead of three or four. Like, it's only Friday and Saturday. And then we're going to stay and work on the bikes because the turnaround is so quick to go to Atlanta the following weekend.
Yeah.
That we're going to have to do a bunch of stuff. So we're staying. Basically, we're going to be working on the bikes in the pits on Sunday morning, hopefully in between being able to watch some of the MotoGP stuff. So that'll be cool.
So are you going to stay with the team and just transition over to Atlanta after Austin?
Well, I'm going back to mom's house and then leaving and going to Atlanta just a couple days later. Yeah. So just going to stay in Texas for a few days and then head straight to Atlanta. I'm not coming back here. Yeah. So it's a long stretch, a couple weeks.
Hope the weather's going to be nice.
I haven't even looked that up.
Anne just looked at it, I think this morning, and she said it looks like it's going to be like in the high 70s, low 80s.
Oh, bitching. Okay.
And then at night, it's going to be like in the high 50s.
Okay. So then that's perfect.
Perfection, far as I'm concerned.
If it doesn't show like thunderstorms and stuff.
Right.
You know?
I've always been curious. Like, you just pack your bags and just go and everything's already there and set up for you.
Yeah. Well, the trucks are like little mini motorcycle shops, right? So they have all the stuff we need, including spares of all the stuff. So you walk into one of these semi trucks, the trailer, and it is incredible how much you can fit. 10 pounds of shit in a 5 pound bag, right? And there's a lot. This truck's actually smaller than what I'm used to. For some reason, I don't know. I don't know truck lengths and stuff, but this one's a little bit shorter because it's easier to get around. And I think they used that for their flat track racing for a really long time because they didn't need as much of a rig. But you need all the room for.
Do the Bagger Daddy bikes and the Gixxerator go in the same truck?
Yeah.
Oh wow.
All of it. So there's two. That's another thing is in Moto America, you can only have one machine visible.
Oh.
And then there's this weird gray area of whether you could have another bike quasi assembled.
What's that about?
I think their idea is that they don't want teams projecting power. And the more you have, if you just have backup bikes on backup, you could have two bikes.
Huh.
And you go back and forth. And it's supposed to limit people's expenditures, but it just, I think it kind of just makes everything more complicated, even for most amateurs that are trying the race, because most people would have some semblance of a backup bike, something. At the same time, I kind of understand it, right?
Huh.
It's a lot to have. Like, if you have two fully built bikes, it's expensive, and then all the teams have to up to that, right? So if everybody's up to that level, then that's a lot. Two full bikes, fully ready, perfectly ready to go, all this exactly the same. It's hard to do that, actually, to make them all the same, because then during the weekend, if you make a change on one, you got to make a change on the other, just in case the bike gets crashed and then you have to jump on the other one. You want to make sure it's the same. Then you have to make sure you have all the linkages and the forks are the same and the shock is the same and on and on and on. And that kind of ups the arms race.
Do you guys, I mean, I know it's a MotoGP event at Austin and you guys are kind of like a sideshow to this thing. So does this mean you have to set up the trucks outside and your work area is all outside?
Yeah, the trucks all have canopies. And that is on purpose to be able to go to wherever, and then you have your inclusive little area.
Right.
Normally at Austin, you would have a garage because they have a huge garage thing. But that's right. All the MotoGP teams are there. So right. Moto 2, Moto 3, all that, they're all going to be.
Even Moto 3 is outside usually.
Yeah, but whatever. So you're right. So some fancy people have garages. I don't know how that works. Like, is it all just MotoGP and Moto 2? Probably so. It's been a while since I've seen it. I have never even paid attention, but you're right. Anytime you're walking through the pits, you're seeing Moto 3 bikes out in the pits.
Yeah, they just look like these little teams.
Let's call it the paddock.
Right.
Right? Even though it's all paddock. I don't know. The non-garaged paddock.
Okay, so walk the average listener through what do you guys as a team have to do? Like the 18-wheelers, I imagine there's multiple.
Yeah. All of them at once. They get loaded in. Usually it's the governing body has a layout that they need. They have planned ahead, and they have to suit all of the different team ownership, and there's a lot of marketing that's going on here. So the teams that are obviously paying the most money or have the most presence or are being funded by manufacturers, Yamaha Corporate or Kawasaki or Honda or whatever the thing is, or Harley, they want to be positioned in a good place to be able to show off their truck, which is a huge billboard. And you want people to have easy access to their to see the bikes and the show, which is part of the show. So there's some skullduggery that comes along with that, because then you got to, you know, you're positioning to have a good pit spot, and some places it could be just a distance to the bathrooms and easy access to get out to the track or whatever the thing is. So if you're not in a garage, it actually makes a huge difference. Or if you're loading into a garage, that kind of makes it easy, because then the trucks just back up right to where the garage is generally.
Yeah.
So there's some things that go on there. You have to wait for them to kind of set you, and the truck driver sets it up, parks it. Then the team, and this would be...
And this is all hands on deck?
Yeah, this is pretty much everybody.
Okay.
And again, every team is different, but you usually have a team manager, you have crew chief or crew chiefs, depending on the riders. You have two mechanics-ish per machine, generally, maybe one, in addition to a crew chief. Sometimes the crew chiefs do the work on the bike and share that with a mechanic. Depends on the team, right? Mm-hmm. In our situation, we have a team manager. You have team owner Terry Vance, who's not going to – he rolls in whenever he wants.
What, he doesn't roll his sleeves up and pick stuff up?
I've seen him. He does, but not specifically as load-in, load-out.
Right.
Like, he shouldn't have to do that. So – team manager, crew chief. The crew chief is split in our situation between all the bikes, which is interesting, but it works because it's tight enough of a thing. And I think this was how they did it in flat track, so they've just kind of transferred over. Normally you'd have one for, say, Hayden Gillum and one for Rocco, but in this case he's doing double duty and it seems to work pretty well. So we got that, and then we've got two other mechanics, so the three mechanics total. One for the other bagger, the number one Hayden Gillum bagger, me on the 97 Rocco Landers, and then another technician who works on the 97 Rocco Landers Gixxerator, the mini bike.
The Gixxerator's not coming out in Coda, is it?
No, it's not. But it'll be on the truck, because I don't think they're going back. No, they're going straight from Austin to Hotlanta.
That makes sense.
Right? Because, you know, going back to Indy, unless something crazy. Actually, that was what they were talking about today, is they trying to figure out the shell game of, well, if you put the truck here and then we need to get this and do that. And they're like, no, we can pack enough and have all the stuff we need to do the thing and then come back. And that way we don't have to burn gas up to Indianapolis and back, because that's where the home base is. Even though that wouldn't be that far, it's still. And timeline, we don't have much time.
No, so. I mean, you guys literally got to. So is the plan that you guys leave on Monday and go straight to Atlanta?
Well, no, I think once we're done on Sunday with what we need to get done on the bikes to prep them for Hotlanta, it'll probably leave on Sunday.
Oh, wow.
And then that way the truck driver isn't in any hurry. And also, you know, all trucks, you have to have a logbook, and the better off they are is when they don't have to be pressed, where they can drive whatever the prescribed amount, 8 hours or 10 hours, mm-hmm. whatever it is that they can do in a day. I have no idea what that. I'm not a CDL.
I always want to imagine that there's like, it's like a band, and you guys have like a band bus.
No.
You're all in there talking about the race and like what's going to happen next. Oh, okay.
I thought you were talking about all the trucks at once, because it sometimes happens where it's
I can only imagine convoy. What that looks like.
Oh, it's boy. A full convoy all across, and what's the eastbound and down, right? That's where they've
been. That's right.
So as far as in, yes, it actually was interesting to have that happen, because And the teams that I have been on haven't been quite like that. Like the Westby was such a relaxed, homey, family feeling thing. And we would just know what was going on. It was super small and simple. It was one rider. It was very easy to focus. And then the crew chief, we didn't need to have a sit down. Maybe we should have sometimes, but we didn't need to be like kumbaya. The first day we were at Daytona, Terry brought us on, and I think it was a lot because it was like, this is the first go for the
whole.
And
it's a big
right,
track.
Yeah, this is a gnarly deal. And it was really cool to be in the truck, in the lounge, which is, so there's a lounge at the front of the truck, basically where you see the truck go over the axles, where the fifth wheel
oh,
is.
Oh, no way.
There's usually a lounge. And okay. Most all trucks generally that I've seen have this lounge area. How it gets utilized is different depending on what the team is. But in this team, it was definitely like all of us go up there. The coffee's there. Wow. The snacks are there, et cetera. So nobody can just go in there. The riders can't just go in there, take off their leathers, leave their leathers, which usually are pretty, you know, there's a smell.
They're
right?
They're well seasoned.
Yeah, for sure. And that's like a critical no to leave any of your gear inside the thing.
Right.
At the same time, it is a handy thing for the rider to be able to go into an air conditioned or heated or whatever environment where they can just kind of be comfortable for a bit. So that's kind of the part, the point of it. But I thought it was interesting that we all go in there and that it's more of a combined area in this because Terry's like, nope, we use this. And he has a lot of meetings up there. He meets with a lot of people. This guy, you know, this is an industry heavy, right? Heavy. So when there are people at the track, he's entertaining, he's doing deals, whatever the thing is, he needs to have that area, right? So there's that, and then the rest of the truck from the axles back, from the truck's axles back, is just bins and parts and reels with electrical and air, and you know, we have everything that you can imagine that you need to work on a bike. Like you could field strip. I can't imagine that there's a thing that we couldn't do to the crankshaft if we needed to. Huh. The whole point is not to have to ever do that. I don't think that would be, it would make no sense if you got to the point where you're having to pull engines all the way down. Not that other teams in this paddock have not had to do that.
Oh, really?
Already this year.
Oh boy.
But that for us, that's the whole point is like they have a engine swap structure that just hedges bets and just we swap engines, preemptive strike, just to avoid any potential issues.
Yeah.
And I think the first couple of years of the baggers, they got a bad rap because they were blowing shit up and oiling tracks over
I
and
bet.
Over and over. And it was a problem. Like the races were constantly being, the superbike races were being disrupted because the baggers would leave oil on the track. Ironically, last year, my involvement, we laid more oil, the superbikes did, than the baggers. And I don't think there were even that many blowups. So they've gotten it. They figured it out. Most of the teams have figured out. That means they probably had to pour a lot of money into it. But there's also
I'm sure.
other things that they've, like I think I described on the last podcast, that these aren't, the engine mounts are not allowed to be solid. So because they're not solid, then that allows the engine to do what it normally does, which is vibrate like a freaking paint shaker and then not break in that yield aluminum or cause leaks. So things like that, right? Anyway, so the back of the truck's that. Then there's a split level. The trucks have two levels.
Wow.
So the bikes usually live upstairs.
Okay.
And there's a gigantic lift at the back of all these trucks.
Yep.
Our truck is really bitching because it's a hydraulic. There's two hydraulic rams. And I'm not used to that. I'm used to a very, what seems janky now that I've seen this, where the thing's held on by chains.
Oh, boy.
And it's notable that if somebody was going to come into a race team to deal with just the truck alone is actually daunting as F. It's like, it's a huge thing. And all of a sudden, you've got four people with two or three motorcycles on a lift being jacked up 20 feet in the air with toolboxes. I've watched a toolbox fall off the back of one of these things.
Oh, man, that was going to be catastrophic.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it's horrible. So you have to be super careful. There's pinch hazards everywhere. There's fall hazards everywhere. You just have to be really careful with all this.
Don't lose your finger. Don't fall.
Dude, on so many levels. So anyway, it takes awareness to be
so you guys show up, empty the truck out.
Yep.
And then you as the mechanics in charge of where you put all your tools and everything?
Yeah, they usually have a setup and the crew chief will be like, I want it this way. And then the mechanics will be, well, how about if we do it this way? You know, and until you get that, usually when you're doing it in underneath the canopy. They've done it 100 times underneath the canopy. It's always the same. Canopy is the same footprint.
Right.
It's the garages that can be a little bit different, just depending on where you're going. So you try and make it where the ingress and egress is easy for the bikes to get in and out. And it makes a difference with these baggers because you actually have to like be... Yeah, it's not easy to get them. I mean, they're not horrible. They're not as hard as you would think to push around, but you got to be.
But it's still a 625-pound machine.
It is, no matter which way you look at it.
Right.
So there's that.
Is there a buddy system?
Yeah, ish. There's been a couple times where I've been sitting waiting, but you know that's the way it goes. Sometimes you're right. There's too many people doing too many different things. So you know, grabbing a stand, grabbing another, and having to sit and park firme for like 40 minutes after a race or qualifying session can be kind of a pain in the butt because then everybody leaves at once because when they release, we want to get back to work on the bikes and right. Yeah, no, it's all good.
What are your thoughts about these bikes going to be on COTA? You know, we talked about how demanding Daytona is as a big fast track. COTA is pretty big as well. So I'm really curious what kind of wear and tear you're going to see on these bikes.
I was looking at the stuff from last year. Apparently it's not too bad. They were able to, and it was 110 or whatever it was.
Ugh.
Really bad for air-cooled machines like ours, like extra bad.
Oh, yeah.
And I think they weathered that okay. I don't think it was great, but, you know, hopefully, well, obviously, if it's going to be high 70s, low 80s, that's nearly perfect because that means morning sessions will be nice and cool. The races might be warm. 80 degrees. Who knows how humid it's going to be. It's going to be humid. Whatever.
Yeah.
The track is demanding. But it's not as bad as I would have thought over the years that I've gone to it. It's bad on brakes. Like, you have to pay attention to brakes. But I don't know if you have to with these bikes. Like I've told you.
I'm so curious.
They don't brake. They don't put a lot of pressure on their front brakes because they can't. They'll just fucking keep locomoting forward without. And, you know, it's the way the center of gravity is and how much. And it's a lot of gravity.
A lot.
It's just a very interesting dynamic. I'd love to see like a map of how the bike is handling in 3D where the center of gravity is. Like if you could do one of those, I don't know, make an AI version. Take the data and make an AI lap
right.
And watch the bike as it goes through whatever it's going. And watch the rider and how the rider changes the center. I'd love to see that type of thing. I mean, that could be worth on MotoGP bike. That would be really cool to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some sort of 3D animation like where the rake like, and the trail are moving and you see where the squad of this. Because I don't think a lot of people understand the nuance of that. Like when they're watching a MotoGP race, do you see when the riders are using that ride height device? It is gnarly.
It's super gnarly.
If you're used to seeing bikes in a specific way, then you see it very clearly. But it's nuanced enough to where most people are just they're watching a bike go fast around a track, and they don't see how extreme it is when that thing dumps down on the freaking flattens the swing arm angle, and they just go like freaking gnarly.
It is wild.
Right?
The first time I saw that, I'm like, what in the fuck just happened?
Yeah, so good. And then also when they do, you do see it very clearly when they're at the starting line and they go into the race mode, start mode, which is really cool too. Low, everything's low. Anyway, so love to see that dynamic because I don't think a lot of people can visualize it as well, I'll say.
I think the noise is going to be amazing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, that's going to be... It'll be rowdy because the MotoGP bikes are loud. And they're always going to be. But this will add another because these people
are
not used to... This will be so good. I can't wait to get reactions from some of these guys, right? I'm very curious. I've got to remember to pack my Vote for Pedro shirts, though.
Or else.
All right. Oh, shit. I'm gonna forget that if I don't. I hadn't thought of it in a while. So I bought these Vote for Pedro because of Pedro Acosta.
Right.
Right? And I want to wear a Pedro... For Vote for Pedro... Are you aware? Do you know what that is?
No, I want you to tell me.
Okay. So, I don't know. 20 years ago, there was a movie called Napoleon Dynamite.
Right.
And in Napoleon Dynamite, there was a situation where Pedro is...
His friend Pedro.
His friend Pedro. He's running for class president.
I like his cousins because they shake their heads.
Okay. So, you do know.
Yeah, vote for Pedro or us. Right, yeah.
So, I was like, as soon as I saw Pedro, like elevating, I'm like, vote for Pedro, right? And when I when he was like immediately when he got on the gas, I'm like, I gotta buy one of those shirts. So I went on eBay and bought
I wonder if Pedro's aware of that.
I that's what I'm wondering, and what I'm hoping is that somebody in our realm, and I think I'm gonna have to get with the Motul people because I think they're sponsored by Motul, and so are we. I'm like, hey, get me in. I just need find me a way.
I just want a picture with this guy. With a shirt.
All I need is a picture with Vote for Pedro. Like it's got to
get one for him.
I have that.
I would be so happy if this happens.
I know, but
we have got to know someone that lets you in.
I know, that's what would be really cool. So I got two of them. So we'll see, and it would be pretty. I don't know if he would do it, but
that's amazing. Right? Yeah, I'm really curious about the physicality of the rider on these big bikes on a dynamic track like Coda.
It just isn't. They both say it isn't. You just cannot put a lot of body English into them. You are along for the ride.
You're just hanging on.
You see them getting sideways and slideways, and they are putting body English in it for sure. But apparently it's just not as much as you would think, considering the weight and the size.
Right.
It's just not, because they have to be smooth. Even though they are getting on hanging out sideways, they're still having to do it in a very smooth, controlled manner. It's not Supermoto, even though when you see videos of Rocco on the thing, he's definitely taking it to that. Well, and all of them do, but he, you know, watching him specifically, it's like, wow, he takes right to it. And then you see videos of him at Adam's Kart Track in SoCal on a Supermoto bike doing the exact same thing with a bike that's 1/10 of the weight, probably.
So this last weekend, my best friend Tamer and I, along with a bunch of friends, went down.
Best
to,
friend, really?
I'm kidding. I've stamped him. My best friend. So we went to Thunder Hill. And got to have...
Which is one of the best tracks in the United States.
It is, for me. Wild, I think it's supposed to be the longest track when they open it both east and west up. It's 5 miles.
But you weren't on that. You were the east track.
Which is the east.
Which is the classic Thunder Hill.
3.1 mile long, classic Thunder Hill. Super fun. I have been riding my Street Fighter at every track day for the last year and a half. I don't know why. It's a lot of fun. But this naked bike beats the shit out of you. And as you were talking about, you know, the King of the Bagger riders on these things, I kept thinking about the physicality of it. Like, what does it feel like to be on these things and have to just huck them around and be really smooth on the brakes? Otherwise, you're just, I don't know, understeering it somehow. But here I am on this 200 horsepower naked bike at T Hill, which is, you've ridden it. For those of you who haven't ridden it, I always tell our Northwestern friends, it's like Portland International Raceway and the Ridge had a baby. In that it's got 15 turns, it's got a lot of very, very fast areas, but it requires you to pay attention. I mean, every track does, but it gets interestingly technical where you got to mind your shit. Like turn 3, which is the first real right-hander, has like 4 feet of play area, and then the rest of it is off camber, and every time somebody came off the track, it was there. So I had the privilege of seeing a couple of listeners and some friends, and one of our buddies, John, who is one of the coaches for the Carters group, showed me some lines and really, really helped us out a lot. And so we did a Saturday and a Sunday, and I have never been so tired in my life.
Yeah.
It's like nothing tells you how out of shape you are better than a naked hyperbike on a fast track where you're holding on for dear life the whole time. And like, Teal's such a funny place. Like, you know, it's got the fast areas where the high horsepower bikes can flex their muscles, but then it also has all these like back areas between turn 2, 3, 4, 5, where a little 400 can just be like, bye.
Yeah, sure.
And it's so much fun to watch that happen. It's like, oh man, I'm struggling to keep up with you here. I'll see you at turn 7 and 8.
To set the tone for this place, people, I think for those who don't know the area, this is in Northern California, but it's in the San Joaquin Valley, but it's on the northern end where it starts getting into like, heading into the foothills of whatever, the Trinity Alps. It's on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. It's past Sacramento by an hour. It's in this cool, grassy.
It looks like the Windows 98.
Exactly.
Logo.
And literally, I believe that.
I'm pretty certain that's where they got it.
That it's close. There's that little offshoot. It's like the 5-something that goes from I-5 down to Vacaville. Or I don't remember the
580,
whatever it is. I don't think whatever it is, there's the Bay Area people, they're gonna get hella mad at me
they
for
will
not
correct
knowing
us.
Yeah, they're gonna get hella mad. That area is where those just beautiful
rolling
and most of the year though it's brown,
but so now it's green.
I bet it's really pretty because I'm used to racing there when it was summertime and it always would just be brown, but it's still beautiful.
Hot in the summer too.
Yeah. I rode there one time at 105. I actually raced there at 111. I was in a Dodge Tradesman 200 up the San Joaquin Valley with my then girlfriend and my cat, because we couldn't find anybody to handle the cat. And this this was a Maine Coon, big old furry Maine Coon. I felt so horrible, but we had no choice. And
we drove up,
and it was 111 when I was racing. It was racing 125s back then. Anyway, horrible. Anyway, but beautiful. No trees in that area.
None.
So, but the hills are there, and the track itself is not flat. There's long stretch, like the front straight, it's definitely flat.
Yep.
And it goes right next to the pits, as it would.
Mm-hmm.
But then it goes in the back, and I can't remember what they call it's not a corkscrew, but it's like the hill.
The carousel?
Yeah,
something
like, but it's a really
turn
unique.
Turn five, you kind of go up and down.
You go up, and then when you get to the apogee, you better be pointed correctly.
Yep.
And then when it goes down, it's another of this weird off. It's not necessarily that off camber, but boy, does it feel like it is.
Yeah, just enough to make you pucker.
Right? And you just don't know whether you can give it the beans or not, but then you do. And then the next few corners are my favorite.
Boy, you give them the beans.
And it's so much fun.
Turn 7 and 8, you're
100
plus miles an hour, just flat.
Yeah, it's
really good. On the side of your bike because you got to make these two left-handers passing everybody.
Yeah, so good.
It's so much fun. And then you go to turn 9, which is another kind of uphill that you can't see what's on the other side. So the first time I did it, they're like, look out for the water tower. And I remember getting to the top of the turn and being like, what the fuck water tower are they talking about? It's like this low-lying silo that you have to look way out for. And once you have it, you can just aim for it and give it the beans and wheelie out of there. But if you don't do it right, you end up in the dirt immediately. So,
and it's no bullshit. You're not just ending up in the dirt. You're going really fast.
Oh, yeah.
And I've done it. I did it on a 125, probably my first lap or second lap there. Back. Oh.
Just dropping stuff.
Oh,
just dropping stuff.
Probably 99. This would have been year 2000 was my first year there. And it was just like, oh my gosh, running off a track, going that fast, gathering it back up and getting back on and being like, okay, check. Now I know.
Don't do that again.
Don't do that again. Right. That's the way it goes. Sure. I actually had one of my favorite moments our good friend Nobi Isu.
Who was there?
Was he really?
He was there. He's helping a fellow Moto America rider.
Oh, okay,
get
sure.
ready to get their shit together on a RS660.
Oh, bitchin'. Yeah. All right, so Nobi was 20 years ago the highest level 125 rider in the nation, and there was a couple of other people that were super fast, a woman named Vicky Jackson Bell, a kid named Peter Hoffman. Anyway, the fastest people were from the Bay Area. There was a lot of money. This was right before the dot-com bubble of 2001.
Okay.
Okay, so there was this... there was a shit ton of money, and there was a shit ton of people racing motorcycles for AFM. And we had I was in something called the USGPRU, and we had one of the rounds. It was a nationwide series that would go there. And I was following Nobi one time, and I was on a old, clapped out, it's hard to explain it, but a pre-95 Honda RS125 still had an engine case that was based off of a dirt bike CR125.
Oh.
And then after 95, there was a bespoke, counterbalanced, high RPM, bitchin', proper motorcycle. Whereas this was like this hodgepodge. Honda was like,
Parts bin bike, you know?
Yeah, why don't you just take that CR? And they would rattle themselves to death because it was a dirt bike with no counterbalancer. And it would rev to like really high, like 12, 13,000. Yeah.
Forever.
Made to go rip and then go. Or should I say
brep
and go. But this instead of just me, and they would just rattle themselves apart. Anyway, I was on this older bike and I was behind Nobi and I was so stoked. I was going fast.
Oh man, Nobi-san.
He towed me down to I don't know if it was like a 2-minute lap time, but it was a fast lap time for 125s there.
Wow.
And then we get on the front straight, but this is like two laps and he's just cruising along butter smooth. I'm like, oh man, I'm fast. And he looks around like in that slow kind of turnaround. And I don't know him that well. I just know that he's the smaller Japanese guy in the paddock. And then he takes off and it was like he was just riding around in practice.
He was just playing.
We were qualifying.
Right.
And he was just riding around like nothing mattered. And when he pulled the trigger, and he ended up setting like 2 or 3 seconds a lap faster, but something obnoxious.
Shish
where I'm
kebab.
Like, anyway, it was a good moment because it was like he helped me greatly. Like I learned a lot by just following him at that time.
Right.
Yeah, but I didn't. I couldn't. There was no way. He was on an Aprilia that my bike probably made 35, maybe 33, 35, or something like that. The good Hondas made 40 to 43, depending on how well it was tuned. Huh. And he was on an Aprilia, good old Spiros, who had, no, he, actually, this is back in the day when he probably had the direct connection to Gigi.
Yeah.
My guess is that Gigi was probably one of his people at Aprilia.
Gigi Delinea's Aprilia days.
Right? So I think, and that bike probably made over 50 horsepower. Probably.
Wow.
It was insane to watch because that bike was so fucking cool. It was just bitching because it was perfect. It was in MotoGP. It was basically like a Moto3 bike now. It was the closest you could get, couple year trickle down, fully kitted, all the trick stuff. It was really neat. Anyway.
That's actually neat. So he was helping somebody with an Aprilia there. And then as I was chatting with him about something, somebody rolled in like a 2006 Chevy Silverado with the shiniest Cup Racing Aprilia RS250.
Yeah, right.
And just all of us stopped and pointed like, what the fuck? I want to ride that. that's still one of my top 10 favorite bikes that I would love to have.
That out of, there's a few bikes that for me, are tragic disappointments, and that was one of the top ones because
really?
I raced one of those briefly.
Why? Tell me why. Break my heart a little because it's one of my favorite bikes.
It could barely go as fast as a 125.
Really?
Yeah, barely.
God, like, these were supposed to be like 67 horsepower.
Nah, bullshit.
Twins.
Bullshit. Yeah.
Really?
No. The motors in those. Okay, so two stroke race bikes.
Right.
Like a real Honda RS250 or a TZ250 Yamaha that you could get as a normal human being that you could purchase, and this is back in the late 90s, early 2000s, you could, through specific dealers, Yamaha or Honda, buy one of these race bikes. You would have to either put your name on a list or you'd have to be one of the fast people, or it wasn't just to like every Joe Schmo or Betsy Schmo could go in and buy one. You had to kind of had some provenance, or you just generally rich person. It was like, okay, I want this, right? So those bikes were like 90 to 95 horsepower.
Damn.
It
really?
They didn't come out of the box that way, but what Rich Oliver, who was the Roland Sands, Chuck Sorensen, these are the US 250 racers in the late 90s, early 2000s. The 250 class lasted in the AMA until 2003, I believe.
Okay.
Maybe it was 02, whatever. These bikes got up to about that. Guaranteed the bikes that are racing, I don't know, whatever the 250s ended up being in 2009, whatever Marco Simoncelli was still racing, they probably had 110 horsepower. That's really gnarly because
God,
those
can
bikes,
you imagine?
Those they didn't weigh any
nothing.
I don't even know what the weight would be. Like, I don't even know if they were close to 200 pounds. A 125 was, I think, I haven't looked this up in so long and I don't remember the weights, but they're really light because it's two-stroke. There's not very much to it, right? So the 250 race bikes were gnarly. The Aprilia,
the Priller
was based off a production bike. And
because there were road bikes in Europe and everywhere
absolutely.
Else.
And it was still, you know, the Honda and Yamaha were still making street bikes, I don't know until when. In Japan, the two-stroke still lasted. We stopped making them whenever it was in the early mid 80s.
Right.
That anything over 50cc stopped. I can't remember what year, but we had RZ500s and RG500 Gammas that the Suzuki and Yamaha had in the 80s. That was the last of the RZ350, whatever. Those were the last of them in the 80s. So they had continued on in the Aprilia for sure. Was still going, but they made this cup challenge because Aprilia was coming to the United States.
Right.
They were trying to make a splash.
I remember they were $10,000.
Which, it's interesting to think about.
Brutalia had one back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And it was sure. MSRP, $99.99.
Yeah, for sure. That's funny to think about because, oh, man, the days. Anyway, so I got, but they had a Proitalia, eventually got a race bike. Somehow, some way, it came through, it was on trade or something like, hey, do you want to race this? Sure. And I'd been racing 125s. And I got out and I raced. I didn't do great, but I didn't do horribly. I was like, I'd get on the podium, but it wasn't like, I wasn't that, I didn't meld with it because it was such a turdy, horrible, ungainly thing. This bike was set up really well. It was
like a race bike.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is it had been raced in the Cup Challenge and it had been raced by some fast people. Like, it was capable for sure. And it's just the power band sucked and the chassis wasn't that good. Again, I'm coming from like a scalpel and this is like a good pocket knife. Like, it's still going to cut. It's not
this
a butter
is your
knife.
Cricket knife, not a
right.
Not like a proper chef's knife.
No, but it's still a nicely done pocket knife. Maybe. Maybe, but it's not like a, it's not a broadsword. It's definitely not a butter knife. It's not a freaking. It's not even the one that you'd spread your jam with, right? It's just and it just that bummed me out because I really because they're beautiful. Yeah. They really do look
they're
the
very,
part.
Very pretty.
They're cool looking motorcycles, no doubt. I have the poster.
And it's aged so well.
They and you know that so that I will admit I just saw a picture of the Aprilia Cube.
Oh yeah.
The first one. I hadn't seen a picture of it in a long. This was one of the most the largest failures of motorcycle racing was when they made this and it was horrible. It was a bad. This is Aprilia's first MotoGP bike and they commissioned Cosworth to make the engine. It was a triple and they just commissioned car people to make a motorcycle engine. So all it did was made power, but it didn't make usable power.
Right.
And then it caught on fire famously with number 45, Colin Edwards on it. And it was a that kind of it soured and soured. I just saw the picture I saw was Jeremy McWilliams on the one of the later iterations. It was white with the lion's head on the side.
Oh, yeah.
And it was when they changed to the angular style to mimic the then RSV 1000, which had turned into this very specific. It was pretty. That bike was so cool looking, mm-hmm. but slow. Not good. Right.
I missed those that era of Aprilia's design.
It was so good.
They were so cool.
They had some pretty bikes. Anyway, so that was that bike. Disappointment. Didn't like racing it. Didn't want anything to do with it. I'm glad I never had to get on it very much. But that's what I'm saying. Don't meet your heroes. You know what I mean? Sometimes you're like, whereas if you'd have gotten on a well set up TZ250,
melted your pants off.
Oh, dude, they're so cool. They're like, I got to race a RS250 one time Honda, which was slower. Like they were known for not being as good. And this was a single side swing arm version. And I loved it. I thought it was fun, but it wasn't. I've always wanted to. And to this day, I want to ride a really well built TZ because I know they are the shit. Especially in the United States, for some reason, the chassis are good. Anyway, that's dream stuff. Track days. He's talking about track days. I'm missing out. FOMOing a little bit. But what would I have as a track day bike? That would probably be, like, if I didn't have an attachment to my 848, which I love dearly,
right?
I would probably, like, if I had the money, I would find an old two-stroke like that, for sure. Just because it's such a pure thing. There's no kickstand provision on the bike.
No.
There's no headlight wiring harness. No. There's no charging system. You bump start it.
Ugh.
Bump start. Like you run with the bike and then you jump on it and you
Le Mans style.
That's how you start it. Unless some people had fancy little gun things on the side, but that was rare. So it's either that or rollers where the thing spins the rear tire. Yeah. But generally, if you were good and you knew how to tune your bike, you could get it to where it would start very quickly. Some people I could see on a 125, they would take the rear tire warmer off and start
it
with that.
Spin it hard with that.
Yeah, if you could do that.
That's
right?
Amazing.
Anyway, so that's the purity and that's the beauty of those bikes is that they're just for racing. That's it. That's all they want to do is go fast. They suck going slow.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And most race bikes, even my A48, when I was doing like track day, I went from having a 10.98 Street Fighter where I was a track day slash instructor-ish, coach-ish guy.
Right.
That thing was so easy and you're sitting up and you got a mirror. When I would do the same thing on my A48, it was a nightmare because it's like you're on a rack, right? Speaking of that, to segue, can I segue?
Please,
I
wish.
So this past weekend, preaching what we were talking about in one of the last episodes.
That's right. Jamie, the season's here.
Yeah,
the
season's here. So Jamie, I was like, it was a beautiful weekend. Right? Didn't we have 2 days of like
gorgeous
sunshine?
Sun.
It was amazing.
Yep.
So I was like, Jamie, let's get your bikes out and go. So she has a F4i, like 2005 or 6-ish Honda F4i, and a 250, I don't know, CRF 250L. So, street bike, dirt bike thing, right?
Perfect.
Get them out of the garage. I'd ridden my Africa Twin over there, and I'm just going through them, right? And as you're clean, it's dust and cobwebs,
touch all the things.
Dust, right? God, you do have to. And sure enough, there was a nut missing on the clutch lever pivot bolt that you wouldn't notice unless you're out there looking and you're pulling it and then you see the little pivot bolt moving. You're like, that shouldn't move.
Right.
That little things like that. Turn signal. She had dropped it a while ago. Turn signal needed to be a little fiddled with, whatever the thing is. You make sure the battery was charged. You get it started. You make sure oil's in it, whatever the thing is. So it was really good to go through that, practicing what I preach, going through the chain, cleaning up, new lube, you know what I mean? Getting everything kind of fresh. Then we went for a little ride, and we just went for a teeny ride around basically the center of Portland, just to go up over Powell Butte and Mount Tabor, just because, right?
Yeah. Get out. This is beautiful.
Not too long. But I will say, and again, this is back to the original point, fucking uncomfortable, man. These sport bikes, I can't.
I don't know.
And this is an F4i. That's like
Like, it's a comfortable.
Arguably
it's a comfortable
one of the more comfortable.
It's
like,
almost like a touring bike.
Almost. But this was when Honda was starting to skew towards it. But still, it was not like a CBR 600RR.
No.
And this is in the same era.
Right.
And I was still like, my wrists, fuck, man. It's like, am I old? Or was this the same way 15 years ago? I did buy an 848. When I was at Ducati, I bought a street bike that was all in parts. And I got it cheap and I put it back together and I sold it. And I rode it to Astoria. And this was 10 or 15 years ago. And I remember thinking, fuck this. They're so uncomfortable.
So uncomfortable.
But you get on the track, of course. It's perfect, right?
It's made for that.
I know.
These are track bikes that would just happen to have lights on them.
So
it always cracks me up when we sell a super bike to someone and it's like, oh, I'm just going to commute on this. I'm like, dude, falling down the stairs is more comfortable, yeah, man. What are we doing here? But it's a hot bike. Doesn't like going slow.
Yeah.
You know, it's geared like to the stratosphere.
Yeah.
First gear will do 100 miles an hour all day long.
Easily. Yeah.
So like... And it's funny, and that's why I love the Street Fighter, because I can sit upright,
yep,
be comfortable, do the thing. And then because my 999's sort of just been sitting.
Yeah, sure.
I was like, fuck
this
it,
is
I'll
a
just,
track bike, just to make,
yeah,
sure. Yeah.
So I have a 2003 999S, which will be getting a full kind of a massage here next week. We'll do belts on it, change the oil, new chain.
Awesome.
We got to change the fork seals, weeping a little bit.
Mm.
But like, that bike is a purpose-built machine.
And if you crash it, yeah, it's a bummer.
It's a weird thing to say. It crashes really well. I found this out once now.
And then you don't have to worry. It's like, same with my 48. Do I want to crash it? No. But it's made to be... Literally, I have put the shit on it to make it to where it's crashable. And then you could literally ride it away, usually every time,
yep,
right? You might have a foot peg hanging off, but you could still get it. Anyway,
it's fine.
That's the type of shit that you need as a track day bike if you're super serious. Which,
yeah, meanwhile, the really pretty Street Fighter, if I wreck that, I'll be so bummed.
But and I going back to the Thunder Hill thing, I had gone to this exact track day over a decade ago on my Street Fighter and crashed in the cold and had to do the walk of shame to find a brake lever, mm-hmm, in the pits, found one, did the rest of the track day there because it crashed well enough, right? And it was just cold tires in the morning. You know how that goes,
just,
right?
Just get out there. You get the red mist, even though everything in your head's saying,
well, really
slow
what
down,
it was.
Slow down.
And that's just a good lesson. I learned that tire warmers at a track day aren't always good. Like, if you're able to get the tires warm and then you go out and can run race pace and keep the tires hot,
right,
then okay. But you generally don't do that at a track day,
no,
especially if you're instructing or if you're helping.
Yeah.
So then if you get out and you feel the grip of fresh off the warmer tires and you're like, fuck yeah.
You got
then
all
your
the confidence.
Your brain goes into, oh, I have all the grip. This
right.
is the grip I have, what I'm getting through turn 1, 2, 3, 4, come around that horrible off camber one, fuck yeah, grip, you know, Thunder Hill. And then you do a few laps. And it's still good, but then the last lap you come around and it's gotten cold. The front tire's gotten cold and then tip. So I learned my lesson at that time. It's very rare that I would go to a track day and use tire warmers. I let them come in. It allows you to just ease into the session.
Yep.
If there's people out there going faster than you, it's not.
It's a track day.
Right.
You're going to win track day. Good
job. So the more the ego has, you get the ego death of being like, I don't care if they go, whatever.
Right.
They'll come back around and maybe I'll play with them then. Whatever. You know what I mean? You're not really worried about it, but a lot of people do. They want to go out and they want to get all their money's worth out of a track day.
The red mist.
Oh, and then if it's a hot day and the ambient temps, like at Portland in the summer, I could see using tire warmers for sure.
Yeah.
Because it stays warm and then you know.
It's consistent.
Right. But if you're at it's cold, be very weary.
Be
very
weary. I love good street sport tires.
Yeah.
Because they don't take that long to warm up.
Yeah. They're made for it.
They stay consistent.
Yeah.
I've been running we'll have to look at them when we're done recording here. So I've got the Pirelli Rosso Corsa 4s. The 2s.
They're up to the 4.
They're up to they skipped 3. There was no 3. They just went
really?
From 2 to 4. I don't understand how math
There's
works
probably
in Italy.
Some, what is it called when you have a superstition? There's some
right.
Italian
right.
superstition.
Three
where like,
no
bippity boppity, no, but
no
3. Tre, no 3.
No 3. No 3. So it's one of those dual compound tires. You get them really hot, you see the compound line immediately.
Yeah, sure.
But these damn things are grippy as fuck. And then I rode on these very same tires to L.A. So I did like a 1,000+ miles of back country roads.
And slab. You had to
and
slab.
Absolutely. I
yeah.
slabbed for at least 200-300 miles easily.
Yeah.
And then did a couple of track days last year and then I looked at the tires and I was like, these seem fine. And they were. And took them to T Hill, and that turn 7 and 8 that we talk about chews up tires, especially on a 200 horsepower bike.
Yeah.
So if you look at my tires, the right side is like, great. The middle's fine. Left side, it's a slick. It's gone.
Yeah.
It's destroyed. And it's like, okay, time for some new tires.
And be weary of that. Because what happens, and I had this bite me on a set of Dunlop yeah. race tires where...
A $600 problem can very quickly become a multi-thousand-dollar problem.
And it was. And yeah. I had been, again, when you're a rider coach person, you just put in laps and put in laps yeah. and put in laps. And you don't notice. And one time I had used the same set of tires for like 3 or 4 track days.
Woo!
Instructing something like you know what
oh,
I mean
buddy
and I was on that A48 and I boy when they let greasy and let go it was full it was one of the only
you have
high
grip
sides.
Till you don't
I have not high sided many times in my life in fact there's I this might be one or two maybe anyway it was a rare one and it was at Grass Valley Oregon Raceway Park.
Oh good because you have to go on a fucking long journey to go to the hospital
yeah,
from there.
Well, right. And I rung myself heavy. It was definitely a chest hit type
right.
of thing. Anyway, that was a lesson learned because I was like, I wonder how long I could go on these. And I should have not done that. if you think I could get one more track day out of them, no, there it is. Like,
right.
When you're done with that last one, I bet I can get one more track. Nope, stop. Buy another set of tires, right?
Let's have a layperson's conversation about, I am just going to get back into track days. Maybe I've done,
yeah.
Let's just say even if you've done 20 of them in the last 10 years.
Sure.
Season's here. Everyone's getting excited. You got your motorcycle. It's in your garage. You probably, if it's a dedicated track bike, it means it does maybe like 8 to 20 rides a year on a, like 20 is really high. The average person does maybe 10.
Yeah, sure.
Like super privileged gets to go to every track day ever.
Yeah.
So that means the bike doesn't get ridden much. It's just sitting there. It's collecting dust. What are you doing? Like Quentin Wilson, tomorrow you got a track day. What is the checklist you go down between your gear and your motorcycle to be able to show up at 7:30 to the riders meeting and go, okay, I'm good to go.
Tires first.
Okay.
At least look at them, make sure that, you know, say you know they're fresh.
Right.
Well, check pressure. Make sure you have your caps. Not a lot of people check the caps. That's actually a lesson I learned on the Aprilia Cup Challenge bike. It had valve caps that did not come out sideways. In that era, Ducati had the ones that come out axially.
Yeah, love those.
And that's the way most have gone over the
right.
years because it's way easier to get access. Well, this Aprilia did not have that. I don't know if they were swapped or whatever. And I went out. Unbeknownst to me, without a valve cap in the front.
Huh.
And at Willow Springs, which is an extremely fast track, 9 turns and average speed is really high. Like only 9 turns, very fast. One of the fastest corners in the nation. Anyway, first lap, great, but then got into the second lap and it was feeling funky. And then I got in the third lap and it kept feeling weirder. Pull in, I was like, I don't know what's wrong. And then found that I had like lost all the pressure because the centripetal force without the cap on, if a cap has a seal, so a metal cap with a seal, this mm-hmm. is why most race organizations and or track organizations require you have a metal cap with a seal, but even a plastic one will do the job of keeping that little valve core, which is it's spring loaded. Mm-hmm. When you press the air chuck on it, you're depressing a spring to allow the air in, the higher pressure air in. So it had been bleeding off at high speed. The centripetal force had forced it open. So I had never heard of that. I had never experienced it. I learned that lesson, and I'm glad I didn't crash.
Right.
Right. So there's easy things first is that checking nuts and bolts on brakes. You don't have to nut and bolt your whole bike, but I usually will go through, look at all the brakes, just put a wrench on everything, make sure it's tight.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have to put a lot of pressure on anything that goes to a brake line, but I'm really talking about the mounting bolts that go from with the caliper to the mount spot. Make sure the pressure is good, and remember that you're starting off your first weekend in a long time. If the tires are from last year, you just be really careful with them.
Super careful.
If they're fresh, then I personally will take brake clean
mm-hmm.
and spray it on a rag, not on a tire.
Right.
And I will lightly put it on the rag, and then I will wipe the tires down with brake clean, yes, but not a lot. And I'm just skimming off whatever it is that might be, could be chain lube, could be release compound,
right,
could be whatever. That's just what I do. Not everybody will like that. I'm sure there somebody will give me some sort of, well, methyl ethyl death will change the blah, blah, blah of this. And yeah, F off. That's what I do. It's worked for me for 20 years. So
if
like
you don't
that.
Want to do that, though, at least be weary of a brand new tire.
Yeah.
Don't go out there bananas.
And look at the full, when if you're doing tire warmers, look at all the way around the tire, looking mm-hmm. for, if the tire is low, their tires bleed down over the winter, you're going to lose pressure. But if it's like down low and it wasn't on a stand and it was like on a kickstand,
right,
or something, I don't know what it would be.
A little flat spot on it.
Yeah, be wary that maybe you have a nail or something, which is a bad deal. You don't want to go out with the tire losing pressure. It's a really bad thing. So do that. Checking the brakes in general, looking at the pads, finding out how to look at pads. Some people don't know how to do that. I'm sure there's somebody on YouTube that's look at, yeah, you get your flashlight out.
Flashlight.
He's making the flashlight.
Making the
symbol,
flashlight though,
right?
Thing.
Have a look at your brake pads. Fuel. Start the bike the night before. Start it in the morning. So many people get to the track and their battery's dead.
Yeah. Oh my God. So many.
And then it starts your day in a nightmare.
Frazzled.
Right? You're frazzled. And you're missing your, you just spent $300 or $200 or whatever it is, and you want to miss a session. It's the first session you want to get ready, blah, blah, blah. And then it makes it even worse. So don't do that. Try and get your battery tender on. Verify that it starts the night before and the morning of, and have it on the tender the whole time. Be ready for that. Gear-wise, definitely make sure your shields are clean and that you have your gloves and your helmet and your boots and your leathers in the same bag. I've had this happen, so many times.
I know. Because
people come to the track without a helmet. And, you know, it's just the frazzled first track day stuff.
Yeah.
So that, for me, that sitting in the car, you're about to turn the key and you're about to go out of your driveway, do that final. And that final, boots, gloves, helmet, leathers, and think of them. Putting their hands on them, and then the bike, you're like, is there gas in it? Do I have my can with me? If not, is it easy to get gas? Checking the level of the fuel, making sure you're good there. Those are the first. Then tape, remembering
especially with a street bike.
If you have a street bike, you have to tape your lights.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly love using blue tape, and then if I am worried, because it comes off easy, and if you're worried about looks, then you put the black duct tape on top of the blue tape,
yep,
and it peels away 10 times easier, and there's no residue. So that's a trick that I would often do.
Painter's tape goes a long way.
What's that?
The painter's tape goes a long way.
It's really good.
It's a great product.
That's the start for me, I think. That would be the beginnings of the... Right,
I'll add a couple of things.
Stands?
Yeah.
You know,
like, so it depends, right? We always tell people that, especially if they're coming to their very, very first track day, keep it simple. I think every track organization is going to be different, but at Moto Corsa, we bring tons of canopies,
yeah,
and chairs and everything.
Yeah.
And there's always somebody who buys a bike from us and is like, hey, I want to come to a track day. What should I buy? And it's like, well, I can give you a list. But if it's your very first one, you're likely going to be a C group. There's probably a classroom. There's going to be a lot of downtime. So don't worry about all the stuff. Just make sure your bike's in good shape. You know, do all the things, you know, Q said. A lot of dealerships, I know we do, we tell people, hey, just bring your bike by. We'll look at it really quick.
I thought you had to get the sticker.
Well, no. So we do bike and gear check at the track. But you can bring your motorcycle to the shop the Saturday or the Wednesday before, and we'll just give it a quick preliminary look just to tell you, hey, these are the things we look for.
Oh, cool.
And also,
and you do that, like, you don't charge them for that? Oh, that's super cool.
No,
okay.
It takes us 2 minutes.
It's not that long to have an expert look around at it. Yeah,
just
for sure.
Just a quickie. And this is a great way for you to just to make sure that things are okay. Now, if you got your bike checked and then you went for a ride and you dumped it,
yeah, sure,
don't expect that it's going to pass.
No, of course. It'd be like, all things considered,
right,
you're bringing basically the same thing, even if it's on the back of a truck,
right,
because it's a race bike only.
Yeah, we still want to make sure okay. A good track organization will check your motorcycle to make sure your brakes, your clutch, your tires, your chain, everything's okay. But make sure you check things like your oil drain. Make sure it's tight. We've had bikes
yep
that didn't have them and they just dumped
Well, and so this is a gray area of race bike to track day bike. And a lot of people think, well, my buddy said that I had to have safety wire and I had to dump all my coolant out. And
right.
on the track day, you don't.
No.
It's a bit of a freak out because if you do crash and coolant gets on the track, it's a problem.
Right.
But it's just not as common that it becomes a problem.
Right.
But that's a notable thing. If you're into track days and you're serious and you have a track bike that's prepared, you probably have the thermostat removed and you probably have water. And if it's over winter time, you probably have a cracked cylinder head because you forgot to take the water out.
Right.
Right. So often that would be the next thing would be if you're serious and you have a track day bike, it's checking wheel bearings. When the bike's up on the stands, you know, trying to adjust the wheel a little bit and move it to see if your wheel bearings are good. And then making sure that you don't have water in it during the winter time when it can freeze and crack the engine because, you know, I ice. So that would be definitely something that a lot of people are like, well, I thought I had to have that. No, but if you have a good look around and if you just did your oil, having another wrench on that drain bolt, just give it a little,
just a little something.
Right. You don't ugga dugga.
Right.
No ugga dugga needed.
Nope. We're just making sure shit's
right.
Tight.
And if you're worried, then you can bring it over to the technicians. And there's usually somebody that's competent that's going to be able to, especially a Moto Corsa, there's always somebody there that can be like, hey, I just did my oil change. Can you check my drain plug? Awesome.
Yeah,
right.
Totally.
Hey, can you check my brakes for me? Awesome. And that's the cool thing about good. And I'm sure Carter's or whatever, you just whatever. Yeah. There's people that are always willing to help. As usually if somebody has a vest on and they are an instructor, that usually means they are serious enough to have had to work on a lot of their own machines. Now, that said, some of them are on the sales side.
That's right.
And the sales dudes that unfortunately have kind of like the Dunning-Kruger effect level of, oh, I'm a mechanic, I'm good to go, not always are the best. And I've seen that, unfortunately. Oh, yeah, I have tools. Yeah, no, you don't. So go to the technical people,
right.
Find out who the technical right. person is. Go to the main people, say, hey, who is a technical person that I can have look at the bike?
Right.
Always do that.
It's,
Vet
it's
people.
Never, ever a bad idea. Basically, just bring your bike to a shop if you have any questions before the track day. There's no reason not to take these precautionary steps. They don't take that much time, and you're going to pay good money to be at any track. Whether it's $200 or $400, it's still money spent. And you're better off not wasting it in that morning because it's so easy to get frazzled. And so, you know, most track, you know, organizations will have a long laundry list of things that you ought to do. The thing of it is the lowest common denominator doesn't read that whole thing. And oftentimes we'll get people
yeah,
that show
sure.
up. Fuck, this last track that I was in, there was a guy that showed up in Nike low tops. Like full race suit, knee pucks, helmet, gauntlet gloves, Nike low tops. And then when somebody was like, you can't do that, he was like, what are you talking about? Like, bro. Have you ever gone down on a motorcycle?
Bro.
Have you ever had your Nike low top protect your ankle? Because you're going to lose
That's
your foot.
That's crazy.
They look super cool.
But they look cool, right? What the fuck? What's weird is to think that somebody
right?
did, like, seriously had leathers?
Like full gear.
Wow, okay.
And it's funny because, like, I remember we saw it and we were kind of pointing at it like, there's no way. And then he got on his bike. We're like, there's no way. And then he got to the line. We're like, there's no way. And then the person at the line went, there's no way. Get the fuck out of here. Like,
no way,
bro.
No way.
So, yeah. Now, the one thing we do at Moto Corsa, which some track days organizations don't do, is gear check. We're making sure that people don't show up with Nike low tops. Like, we want to make sure you've got proper ankle protection. You got a suit. You got a back protector. You got, you know, double closure gauntlet gloves. A helmet that's not from fucking 1985. We had a guy show up in an RF 600. Like, my guy, the foam in your helmet is so brittle I can crush it with my pinky tip. Right.
That's like 1998.
So, and there's always an argument. Yeah, well, sure. I bought this helmet. Like, man, I know you've had it for 8 years and you've probably taken great care of it. What I care about is that if you blow turn one and cartwheel down the track, you're going to be as okay as humanly possible. And so...
And unfortunately,
uh-huh.
a lawyer will that. Sorry, but we live in this world now
yes.
where you have to be super careful, and it's very justifiable for anybody to say, "Hey,
right.
if a lawyer got their fangs,
they got them.
Their
sharp.
Evil fangs into into this, and saw that you were in some old helmet, and they'd be like,
yeah.
well,
surely somebody
right?
checked this,
and then they find Yeah, all right. I don't think that that's happened, but I could see it because we've, yeah, it's a horrible tort reform.
Most of us are
torta reform. I may have a good asada. Really good asada.
I've had a birria one lately. Delish. I'm a sucker for a birria. Yeah, we always have these like, here, sign your life away before you get on the track. You know, what is, you know, you get the whole, what's your name? Here's your signature. What are you doing? Ryan Alvandi, signing.
What are you doing?
/ yeah. I don't know, clown. So, just be smart. It's the track day is there for you to become a better, more efficient rider in every way possible. A lot of people look at it and go, I'm going to do the best lap time I've ever done. And you probably can. But know that it's baby steps to get there. And it all starts with you just checking your shit and making sure all your shit is in order. And then slowly work your way to being able to maybe following me. And then maybe, big maybe, following Quentin Wilson. Because I'm quick and he's fast.
Yeah, whatever. So the other thing I will say that I think a lot of people don't, that initial, I got to get out of for every session thing. You absolutely 100%. Can miss the first session. In fact, I actually enjoy it because then the
track
gets cleaned
off. There's a lot of goose shit in
PIR
turn three. I'm just telling you.
And then the rubber does get laid down, even at track days. Plenty of, and that makes a difference. You think, well, rubber isn't permanent.
Right.
It's not like it's getting painted on. The little rubber particles just lay out on the track, and they help. Your tire goes over one of those particles and then hits a sharp little piece of aggregate, and then you got grip. So the more somebody is out there on the racing line, the more it's just easy. So the first session, you let everybody else go out and do the thing. And then, you know, and when I say first session, I mean the first hour, because usually the sessions
20 minutes
are what,
each, usually.
First right. 20 minutes, 20 minutes, 20 minutes, and then boom, you got an hour. So don't rush it. If you get to the point where, like, I'm not going to make it, calm down. Take your leather, the top of your leathers off. Just breathe for a second. Yeah. Get your bike. Do whatever it is that is the right thing. Oh, shoot, you're going to have to take your mirrors off because they ask you to, you know, whatever the thing is, you know, because a lot of people show
That's
up.
Right.
You've got the mirrors on. You're going to have to take them off. Whatever the thing is, don't freak out. Then also, after lunch, be ready. There's what? Usually 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and then sometimes
typically a 4 o'clock. We try to do a 4
sometimes.
O'clock.
Okay. And that is the most, the other than the
session.
First, of course, it's bookended. Ooh. That last session, you're confident. You've finally come into tune with yourself. All the lines, everything is good, and you get over. And then also, usually the tires are starting to get a little bit greasier, and you've gotten super confident because the lines you were like nailing and right after lunch, which is for me always the best because you've had that hour to chill, and then you get back out, and it's usually perfect conditions, and you can just rip. But then it starts to degrade, and I've watched it. I mean, I've been doing track days since 1996. That was my first track day.
It's been a minute.
So wow.
It's been a minute.
So 30 years of doing this shit. At Class Motorcycle School at Streets of Willow. And when I was doing heavy amounts, well, I was doing every motor course a day and every... There was another organization here in the Northwest,
right.
And I was doing ORP like 6 or 7 times a year and every motor course a day. And I was just constant. And it would just be over and over and over. You'd watch that last session of the day. It was just a meat grinder. Just stop it. Be ready to be like, it is margarita 30. I want to get out and not feel like you have to eke out that. I think about it like, how much fun do you want to have? You have your 20-minute sessions. And that is a lot. Like, it's an intense thing. You got your knee down. Maybe you didn't, but you're close. Whatever the thing is, just be aware that that last session of the day is very dangerous. It can be more than any other. I don't know if it's quantified somewhere.
I think it makes perfect sense.
From my standpoint.
Here's the question I have for you as a rider. Are you over the age of 30-something? Stretch a bit. Drink a lot of water.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Tamara
sure.
and I, before the first session, we usually skip the first session. We're doing like these yoga moves, getting the hips opened up. If you haven't done a track day in 5 or 6 months or ridden on the street in a spirited way, chances are your hip flexors ain't what you thought they are. And you're going to go out there into turn 1, 2, 3 and realize that your shit's locking up on you.
this is so critical,
so
and
important.
I can't believe I didn't even think about it. Because you have to do it. Dirt bike riding is a little bit worse even. But for me, it was, especially when I was on the Street Fighter, because I had that bike for many, many years.
Oh, yeah.
And you know exactly what I'm talking about. For me, it was neck muscles. The first track
neck
day,
muscles and hand
I
muscles.
Needed to build
dude, my hands would
whatever
be on
those
fire
neck muscles are. That was always the first one, and every year it would be like that first one. I'd have to deal with that neck thing, and then after that, like a few sessions in the day, it was like okay, but still pain. Like wow, I can barely keep my neck up. And then if my leg, because it would sometimes get winded out because there's no fairing, if my leg did go out at say mid track, mid straightaway at Portland, which is like
a
3/4 of a mile,
you're touching 160 miles an hour even on a naked
it's a
bike.
Long. It is gnarly. Then I could not bring it back because not just the flexor, but whatever the musculature that would want to bring it back, I would have to break just to get my leg just go funk, right? So that's true. And the stretching part, any good, especially dirt bike schools, they usually have you do the thing where you grab your ankle and pull your leg up and then try and, just try and move your leg specifically thinking about, okay, I'm about to try and put my knee on the ground and that whatever motion that is. And then that should be stretching in general. Core stretching is also a big deal. Like twisting around a lot.
Get loosened up.
It's a good point.
I've found riding a bicycle helps a lot with keeping those leg muscles. And it's funny, all the leg muscles that you use to stick your leg out, put it on the ground, move around your bicycle.
Yeah, sure.
It helps them stay limber. The rowing machine
warms them
sitting
up,
here
stretches them out a little bit
immensely with any motorcycling type thing I want to do.
Sure.
It's I've been rowing a lot, and it's funny. I mean, we did 12, 13 sessions in 2 days, and I did almost every single one of them. I didn't do the very last one of Sunday because I went out to the penultimate lap or session and put it all down there and had a blast. We went fast, had an awesome time, had a buddy of ours who got behind me on his Panigale and videoed me. I've never had a video of me on the track, so it was neat to watch. If you have something like that, it's great. It teaches you a lot. You can learn
so
much about yourself.
It's
in
very
your mind's
helpful.
Eye, you're fucking Rossi. Yeah.
Dude, I am hanging so far off.
And
my elbow's
the video
about
go,
on the ground.
My God.
Nope.
I'm stiff as a board.
Nope.
I'm not even
stiff
moving.
As a board.
So,
yeah.
If you go to a track event that has a photographer, pay the money, get the photographs. A, you look really cool. You can show it off to family and friends. But most importantly, it'll help you see what you look like when you think you're leaned way over. It'll help you see physically how you're doing and help you assess a little bit. Now, Quentin told me one of the most important things ever. If you're a big dude like me, you weigh 240-something pounds, you're not going to be able to hang it out as much as Quentin or someone a little bit lighter than me. So, you know, everything comes, it's dynamic, everything is relevant to your size. Yeah, you did.
I said this to you one time. I was like,
you're like you,
dude,
you
you're
big
a fat
fucker.
Ass. You
don't
can't expect to be hanging off like that. What do you,
So
I know.
There was
I can't
a photo.
Imagine,
I posted
I
a photo up, and I was like, I need to work on keeping my, kicking my body out a little bit more. And you were like,
and I probably was like, dude, don't
you're
beat yourself up.
You're doing
up.
Good,
that
and you're kind
good.
Of a big dude.
Yeah.
You don't need to like hang way out and put an elbow on the ground.
Yeah. It's such a funny thing when people, they look,
right.
They, especially within the past 10 years, as soon as Mark Marquez
mm-hmm.
started hanging off so much further than everybody and the fucking shoulders on the ground, all this crap, everybody wanted to emulate it. And I'm like, listen, I get it that right there on that machine and that realm and at the highest level, that is fast. And there's no doubt if you could do that, that's great. But to put yourself, it's almost like knee on the ground. You can go really, 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 really fast around a racetrack without putting your knee on the ground. And a lot of people think that you absolutely have to. There is a break point where you do need to have that more
as
a
just trying
gauge
to see how far that edge
than
of your
it
tire
is a
basically.
For sure, that's the gauge part of it. Some people absolutely use that as a pivot. And these fast people are very fast and they can
I am
do
not that.
That
person.
I don't. I have pairs of knee pucks that will last years. And they're ground, but I
just
do
this gentle.
They're dancing. They're not really, but I know some people.
It's not a grader, it's a
microphone. Real fast. Like you say I'm fast. I'm like 90th percentile fast. Look, we're talking like 99th percentile full on.
The ones that get paid for it.
That really fast, right? And they will absolutely dig in. And then you watch Marquez or Pedro Costa crashing And you see the pivot, and it's the knee. And absolutely, they are keeping that motherfucker up on the knee, and that's an amazing thing. That's not me. And that probably doesn't need to be you. Stop putting yourself in a position where you feel like you have to. Same as you don't need to do the last session of the day if you're already spent.
Like I said earlier, don't let a $300 problem become a multi-$1,000 problem. If you've paid $300 for a track day and you've had a great time and you're tired, walk away. Go grab a margarita, put your shit together, go have the conversation with your fellow track mates who've been doing it with you and talk about every turn and get excited and think about what the next one's going to be like. Because if you go past that threshold, then maybe, and we don't want this for you, but there could be consequences that are going to suck. It ruins everything.
And it does. It ruins everything. It crashing
every time I've done it, I have to sit
so
there for like days and think about what I've done.
I know. It's a horrible feeling. Turn three, right?
Those of you who are in the Pacific Northwest who have ridden that PIR, frankly, in Willows at Thunderhill, Turn three will get you. We're going to do a T-shirt. It's the T3 Club.
Well, one thing that's good is that you don't have the track day that's immediately preceding. Is it preceding?
Prior to?
The right word. The, right afterwards. The swap meet. For the longest time, the Portland PIR swap meet, and it happens like in April.
Yeah.
It's happening soon. Would be like the weekend before the first track day. And I one time went out there and was in the trucks and parked on the track.
Just leaving bullshit everywhere.
Stains. Oh, my God. It freaked me out so bad. I mean, you think shit's bad, but like literally this, like anyway. So that's a thing most people don't think of. And I doubt you don't have to worry. When's your first track day? When's the most?
Wait.
It's long. Way
into over
the
a
season.
Month.
Yeah. Fair
to get ready to be at PIR. And then we're doing the one in June.
All right.
Something. Which is an evening one.
I wanted to do that last year. I'd like to.
You get like the most beautiful sunset.
I
got to
do the thing.
And the trees are tall enough where it's not in your eyes. It's just a beautiful light.
Yeah, that's
it's gorgeous.
That's really cool.
So we had a couple of emails, and you know I read all of them. I love these all so much, and there's always something really really neat like.
And there's more there really than is. We can consume, to be honest with you. So
and
our
don't
apologies
stop sending
if we haven't got to it quickly.
WeRapTalk@gmail.com. Email us. I want to read everything you have to say. But we had asked the question of what is your one favorite bike? And one of the ones that really got to me, because it's one of my favorite bikes too, is from Todd. And he wrote, the one that he saw that he said, I must have, was the year 2000, which is the first year Honda RC51. And he wrote here, or as they confusingly called it, the RVT1000R. Now, I thought RVT stood for a racing V-twin.
No.
So I'm gonna keep calling it that. Racing V-twin 1000.
Yeah, racing. So
right?
The RVF was the Suzuka 8-hour V4, I think there might be some legitimacy in there. You're probably right. It is. I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be, because there's an RC designation in the Honda.
The 30, the 45,
and that's usually their that's their model code. So. I don't even remember No, it wasn't necessarily, but it could be. That could have been. I don't know. I'm sorry. I've had this explained to me at some point in time, and I don't remember. Whatever it is, there was the first one was the RC30.
Right.
That was like the clear. And then it kind of became, RC45. Somebody said, the Honda Hawk 650 was a RC31. I don't know. Right. There is a model code, and I can't. I think like my Africa Twin is SD.
Huh.
06 or something like that. So they do have different letters, and there
I'm
is
sure.
rhyme and reason, as
all,
you can imagine.
Factory
it's all very logical in Honda
what.
World. But the RC51 was, frankly, one of the baddest
to this day,
MFers.
Still is.
It really is, and it has
so
aged extremely well.
They went up in
they
value
look
quite
really
a bit
cool.
recently.
Yeah, no doubt. I can
yes,
I tell you
I
an RC51 story? Okay, so we got one in on trade at Priadati at Protalia, and I did, and I was like, I couldn't afford that, but I got to take.
Remember that bike
that
brand new
really
was $10,000?
Cool
and it was expensive back
that's
then.
That's so crazy to think of. Yeah, that was, it was up there because it was competing with the Ducati, and it was arguably
Love
better than a 916, right? So as soon as it comes in, being a Honda kid that happened to work at a Ducati shop, and I was getting to ride all the stuff. And if they got one in on trade, they would be like, sure, Bill Nation was really cool about that. That was a huge plus to work there, is that they didn't care as long as you didn't fuck something up, which I was, I think I was pretty good. So this one weekend, I take that. And I'm stoked. And I rode it out to my friend's house in Reeferside. Riverside.
Holy moly, you went all the way to Riverside from there?
I was. I did. On the 210. I don't remember what the story is. I think I had to just go out there. And then I took like Wrightwood back. Or, you know, I went over the mountains. Anyway, had a great weekend or that during that weekend or during that Sunday. I went and did that. Full leathers on. I don't know. I was just out being a Skippy.
I want that Skippy energy back.
Skippy. Full race Skippy. So Monday morning, which is the best time at the time to ride up the Angels Crest Highway, because there's nobody, not as many. The Skippies are up there, So that was because you're in the motorcycle industry, you take advantage of the Mondays to go up Azusa Canyon or the Angels Crest Highway. This is a storied piece of asphalt that goes from the center of the Los Angeles Valley-ish thing all the way up to Palmdale, essentially. Right, and it goes to Wrightwood one side, or Andrews Forest Highway goes up to Palm. It's an amazing, extremely well laid out, like the way the mountains are, whatever it is.
Yeah,
it's perfect, or it used to be. So I get out on that, and I have full leathers. I fill up at the Shell station at the bottom. I'm going. My plan was to go all the way to like Bouquet Canyon. I was going to do Castaic. I'm doing a long trip. I had my water hydration pack on back. I'm full leathers, which I normally didn't ride in. And we're talking everything. Like
full
all my, and I was
S.
racing at the time. So I was full fucking Skippy. And I start tearing up. And there is one section. I don't remember. It's not very far away from the houses.
The speed limit there is 35, not 36.
You go pretty. Mm-hmm. You have to, because the cops, and at this time, I don't think the cops had been that bad. This is 2000. Yeah. It started to get really, really bad.
Just a lot of very expensive houses there.
It got worse and worse and worse.
Making crazy noises.
For sure. And there was a lot of, straight up, there's a lot of people dying on that road. That fucking road, it's dangerous because there's no room for error. The guardrails, you crash, you're going over the side, it's a bad deal. So I'm going, and I get past the residential area, and there's that one, there's like a straightaway. Yep. Like a teeny little straightaway, and I come fucking burning out of that last corner onto that because I know it's happening, and there's two lane, and I don't think I was even passing a car. I was just letting it eat, and at the end of it was a cop standing beside their car with a gun on me, and I just kept going.
You eluded.
I mean, what are you going to do?
My hero.
I was like, I didn't elude. I never saw lights.
Even he was like, I'm not catching that dinner.
Right?
I'll just pick him up later.
I don't know. All I know is from that point, I had to do it in my head because it was so fast. I was going so fast. What the heck was I going to do, right? I'm like, what am I going to do? Turn around? And then I was like, full tank of gas, full hydration pack, full leathers. I'm doing Azusa Canyon, or no, what is it? Aliso Canyon. I was like in my head, well, I'll just keep an eye out for helicopters. And I'm going to take Aliso Canyon. And I'm going to do Sand Canyon. And sure enough, I went to Aliso Canyon, Sand Canyon, and went back to the Pro Italia, opened up the garage door, threw that fucking bike in there, got my, I don't know if I had my SD2 at the time, whatever bike I had, I got back on that, and I went home, and I was like, okay, that was my day done. Right. Anyway, never saw lights, never saw any situation where I never saw the helicopter come and get me, but I was like, okay, that was it. And I will say this, that bike was madman,
so much
or
torque,
mad woman, or
it
whatever,
revved right up,
mad person. It really good. It was a really good, and you know, it was an interesting cross at the time between like and the Aprilia Mille was. I had a lot of time on those because I worked there, and the 996. Did it have the same?
The je ne sais quoi?
I don't know. Schutzpa. What is the? It was the je ne sais quoi. Whatever
it did
the
in
thing
its weird
is
way.
That
I love
Ducati
that like cam driven, like the chain driven cams on.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah, it was raucous. But it still didn't have the dry clutch, and it certainly didn't have the steel frame feel. But it was awesome. It was super good. I wish I could have bought it, but I didn't. But it made me also appreciate the Ducatis and the Aprilias as well, because that was like all these bikes. You had such good choices at that time of V-twins that were, you know, it went from not having a bunch. It was all four cylinders for so long. Then all of a sudden, these V-twins came out,
now.
And they were just rats.
It's 2002. You got an RC51, a TL1000R, a Mille, and a 996. 2002, 996. Which one are you taking?
Right now, I think RC 51.
Wow, yeah, even the Melee.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, easily. No, Melees were my least favorite. I hated those things. They did the power. You had to put the full exhaust system on that was like the horrible. And I worked at a place called in between all this. God damn it, we're just going off on tangents. So after I was at Pro Italia, I briefly worked at a place called Evoluzione Cycle Sports. And this dude was in Simi Valley, and he was making tuner parts for Melees. He would bore out the throttle bodies, and he had a chip, I believe, made. And if you put the recipe together, you'd have the exhaust system with the twin exits.
Gorgeous.
Just like Haga had on his, or Corsair had. Similar. It wasn't like that, but they were close. You could get rid of that stupid flat spot. Because the cams were not easy to turn. It was not as easy to tune as the Ducati was. You could just, the Ducatis were just easier to make go fast at the time. They just were. Whereas the Aprilia wasn't. And I just didn't ever get along, and I didn't like the way the chassis was. The funny thing is, as soon as you took all the bodywork off one of those things, it was like the size of a Cup Challenge to fit. Like, it was teeny.
Big bulbous fairings on it.
But those fairings and every, yeah, it was interesting that they chose that. I don't know if it was an aero thing at the time, but it seems, it's funny to see that now relative to what, like, even the V4 Aprilia turned into in 2009. A decade later, it was like more tight and right. Anyway, they're fun, but not they were stonking and snorting. The best one I ever rode was the one I worked on for Famous Guy Friends. Friends, the TV show.
Matt LeBlanc.
Matt LeBlanc. So Matt would come into Pro Italia with his Aprilia, and it was worked. He had done some stuff, but it was kind of eh. And when I went to Evoluzione, he started going over there, and we did I think we might have done pistons. Anyway, we upscaled that bike, and it was amazing. It was like the up recipe that nobody else would pay for because they were fast enough.
Matt just wanted an extra.
I don't know if we did high compression. Yeah, and that dude was really cool. He was pretty down to earth. He would show up in a big old diesel truck. And no, none of the famous people would. It was very rare that they wouldn't just send one of their people, right? He was one of the people that would come in the back door and just start chatting, and he could talk bikes, and he had a piece of property out near Santa Barbara or Santa Ynez. I was one of the go, never did. But I did get invited. He had me come and watch one of the tapings of Friends. Me and Shannon at the time, when we got to see, and it was really cool.
I'm so into it.
We're going to go on more tangents. So we get there. And one of the dudes, there's a group of these people that are in the Hollywood realm that are like, or at least at the time, there was the stunt dudes. And anybody that's cool that's in the motorcycles and cars, like the actors, they would get along with the stunt dudes. And then the stunt dudes are just part of the realm. So we're at Universal Studios-ish, something, you know, close to that's wherever they were filming the Friends. And one of the dudes who I knew through other friends, because I worked on all the gaffers' bikes, on the generator dudes' bikes, on the lighting.
I remember
these are part of the people that you, right? When you're in that realm, you're working on people that do all this stuff. So there's a few of us that were there, and he's like, dude, you wouldn't believe who's here. I'm like, really? Who? He's like, Colin Edwards, who we were just talking about lighting on fire with the Aprilia, and Jeremy McGrath.
What?
So like Showtime. And we all sat. They were sitting in front of me. And so it was me and my then, I don't know if we were married yet. I don't think we were. Shannon. We got to sit, like, watching one of the final. It was, like, within the last few episodes of Friends. And I got to BS with Colin because I'm from College Station, which is not far away from Conroe. So it was just a quick good old boy Texas thing, right? And then the fact that it was Jeremy, I didn't really talk to Jeremy McGrath because I don't give a shit about Dirt's for Potatoes, right? But at the time, Dirt was for Potatoes. I don't care about Showtime. I was stoked about the dude that just went from riding the Aprilia to riding the Telefonica Honda at the time, right? Anyway, it was a really, really, really cool experience. High level shit. So I don't know how we got from Honda RC51.
Matt LeBlanc was riding.
Speaking of RC51s. Yeah, that's right. It was an Aprilia. But speaking of RC51s, the dude that made the RC51, Colin Edwards. What? He won at least one World Superbike Championship with that? At least one. And then almost beat Bayless on another one with the Ducati.
2003 yellow with the shotgun exhaust that was the Aprilia racing kit on. That was such a pretty bike.
Those were pretty cool. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And those sounded really good. Yeah. The shotgun ones sounded good. And they got rid of some of that horrible mid-range, but not like
real
the
work.
Two, the ones out there. Oh, my God. It's weird to think about.
Our man
Todd
that we started talking about initially went from a VFR to this thing. had it, and then in 2000, it met its end at VIR Track Day, which I think is a proper way for a bike to meet its end.
Dude, yeah. If you got a Sayonara or something,
that's honorable.
At a track day.
So then.
Yeah, for sure. That sucks, but listen, and I know VIR. You know, I've good ending there. Here. I can see
found
it.
Found a new and improved 2002, which was, I believe, the SP2 model, which was supposed to be more efficient and better in pretty much every way. And he had this thing from 2002 to 2019. And then he sold it.
That's super sad. He says he regrets selling. I'm like, why? That's one of those you just pretty much have until you're dead. Listen, and you sign it off on somebody.
Todd, I hope you
like,
find
another one. Like,
why would
you get rid of that? Sorry, Todd. Sorry.
I hope you find another one. That bike is so good.
That's a bad deal. I don't mean to make you feel guilty, but why did you do that?
Listen,
I don't
Todd,
know. You know, life happens.
We want to know why you sold it, and we really hope you find another one because that bike is so fucking special. It's a great, great motorcycle. We got another one here. Jason Dunn. Ooh, this is neat. Wanted to get into something different, so he got rid of his Busa. That's fucking sacrilege, man. You get rid of Busas. Busas get rid of you. So he got rid of his Busa and went to bought the most boring beige dad bike you can possibly buy, a V-Strom. No, a V-Strom.
A KLR?
There you go.
Oh, no.
Jason, you're wrong.
Sorry, dude. Sorry. Yeah, you cannot say that.
They
make
a beige
KLR, don't they?
No, you know, and in fact, yeah, uh-huh. It's not even beige. It's black. It's a black V-Strom, which I love the V-Storm.
Yeah.
Is this the V-Strom or the V-Strom? Is it the big one? I can't tell. They're phenomenal.
Either one. They're That's the interesting thing. Those 650s are so legitimate that you don't even need the 1,000.
Style,
I know
I think
that
these go to an 800 now.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that they've changed it because that's the Gixxerator. That's the same engine that's
in
the Gixxerator, maybe.
He's got the Widowata Moscow Moto stuff on there. I'm into it. He's got the spoked wheels on there. So, and the thing's covered in mud and dirt. Dude, you're doing the thing. You're making a as you call
it,
a boring beige dad bike into a fun, dirty, mud-bogged V-Strom.
All of these things can do that. As much shit as I talk about whatever bike, you can go.
Absolutely.
It's what you do with it.
I like
right,
it.
For
I'm
sure.
way into it.
I spent.
God, I don't know as many as you got.
Stories you're gonna have. One time, early days with Ducati, I had the opportunity to ride in something called Moto Marathon in northern Colorado. And a friend of mine let me borrow his V-Strom 1000 to go do the first day until I could get to the Ducati thing. It was a weird, I forget what the weird thing was. But I went from Boulder up and over, I'm not going to remember the passes, but it was bitching. It was northern, from Poudre Canyon, I think is what it's called. It's from Fort Collins. Really pretty. Beautiful ride all the way like Walden or Walden Pond or anyway, central northern Colorado. And I did that in one day with that V-Strom. And, I mean, I was in Ducati land, so it was kind of boring because it's not
the thing.
But it worked
did it
extremely
take you there?
Well. It was comfortable. Did the thing all day long. Right. And you could do it every day. And this was probably a mid-2000s version.
All right,
so I'm
going to
need
the last one for tonight. Again, keep sending these to us. I really, really love these a lot. So this is from our listener, Nicholas, from Melbourne, Australia.
Melbourne.
Anar. Why? Melbourne. I need to know. Arnar, why?
Arnar.
I love Australian accents so much.
Somebody was doing that. We're like, Arnar. And I'm like, that is funny.
All right, so.
Yeah, sir.
I'm going to read this whole thing. It's a sweet email. Hey, Shaw and Q. Just want to say I have had little motivation to ride recently with a newborn baby and busy work life, blah, blah, blah. And this is what they wrote, actually, blah, blah, blah. But the resurgence of the Brap Talk. Felt like a sign to get riding again. Dude.
The Brap Talk. The Brap Talk.
It's just Brap Talk.
Oh, okay, good. Thank you. No, it's the.
I feel like we've done our job here. If we researched someone's need to go ride again, we've done the part.
Yeah, no, that's really good. So it certainly does feel good. Yeah,
my
for
little,
sure. Especially across an antipode. This dude is like, we could drill down and we get to him, right? That's really cool.
All right, so Nicholas got, he says, my little Kawa Z400 is back in prime place in the garage. Oh, I'm sorry, garage.
Kawa.
Garage. Ride little bikes fast, they said, and they are right. Filters, chain, and fluids are clean and loving it. Dude, way to go, Nicholas. Fuck's sake. Dude, track day at Phillip Island. No, he's not.
He's not that far away.
A little push I needed to remember how much motorcycling is. Zach Quartz giggles interested here. Zach Quartz giggle is, I mean, if that's
really funny,
nothing will. Yeah. Look forward to many more episodes. We do too. Nick, Melbourne, Australia. That's fucking, this makes me so happy. So here's the thing. I actually wrote back to Nicholas. And then because he'd put the word Zach in there, my email cleared his name to Zach. So sorry, I wrote back to you. It's Zach.
Yeah.
Nicholas from Melbourne.
Yeah.
Australia.
Sorry.
Careful.
Yeah, Australia. Yeah, they're going to, he's probably like, what did they call us? There's something I just learned the other day. Seppo.
What's a Seppo?
Seppo. And I'm like, oh God, what could be a Seppo? Get this. So Seppo is septic tank. And you're like, why? I mean, I'm like, okay, we're full of shit. And it's like, no, septic tank yank.
Oh, it's like the Scottish
so almost
that make like
cock.
Yeah,
no, Cockney rhyming slang.
Seppos.
So that's central London. So, but it's Australian rhyming slang. Oh, I didn't know they did that too, but of course they do. So Seppo. And I'm like, okay, I'll own that because we are
absolutely
full of shit. Okay, I got one of my friends that it's interesting. I had this conversation with him two nights ago. He wasn't aware that I was ever on any podcast, but he had started writing within I've become friends with him and his partner Brianna, you know, Matt and Brianna, right?
So they write KLRs.
Brianna
has got your bike.
She got it. I went and checked it out for her. I did the serve hey, I give this a stamp of approval. And anyway, really good friends, really cool people, live very close to me in Portland. And we've become friends over the past few years. They had no idea I did a podcast at all. Podcast. So why was I talking about that? Oh, no. So he emails me or texts me. He's like, hey, man, you know that what you guys were just talking about, cleaning your bike. And he sends me a picture of a freaking engine mount bolt in his KLR 650's engine cradle crash guard thing. He's like, I did what you were suggesting. I was like, I should probably clean my bike. And here's one of my engine mount bolts. And I'm like, of course it is, because a KLR just wants to rattle itself to death. It's just reminding you, hey, man, I'm a KLR 650. I'm going to rattle everything apart. But I thought that was really cool because he found it. And he actually has a really nicely built, nicely done. And he has, I just saw this last night for the first time. Instead of the old shitty Pelican case, weirdo, I think it's all old SW Motec stuff.
He got the Widow Wattos bags.
He has the Widow Wattos on the side. I was like, oh, this is like the full circle here. I was super stoked.
Hold on, let me close the circle a little more for you. Brianna is who coached Anne into getting back into motorcycles.
Yeah. I know. And when we had the full conversation, because Brianna is
Team Oregon instructor.
A instructor for Team Oregon and has been for a really long time. So we should go there's some advanced cornering class. Yeah. And I don't know, we should come up with a good F
Farts.
So we can be FART.
Friends of Advanced Rider Training.
Yes! I was racking my brain. I couldn't think of a
friends
good...
Of,
so we're friends of Advanced Rider Training.
Oh, God, I'm going to make that shirt.
So we should absolutely go. And I don't want to quote-unquote crash it. I want to go through it.
Absolutely.
You always learn something. No matter how many freaking miles, how many knees down, how many dirt bikes, how many wheelies, there's something to learn. And if you go to a go-kart track, it's a good day, I guarantee you. A go-kart track and a motorcycle, even if you're going at a slow pace, guaranteed you're going to learn something, or you're going to press something, or
absolutely,
you might help somebody else out.
That's the beauty of all these group riding things, whether it's a track day or farts or any of this stuff. It's a good thing to do it. You will learn something. You will likely help somebody learn something and be their moral support. I mean, Anne just came to a Touratech rally last year, and being around all these awesome women that ride adventure bikes made her go, I want to ride a motorcycle again. Not even an adventure motorcycle. She just wants to ride motorcycles again. So I love that.
Yeah,
I love that
bike,
connection
sure.
we have. So here's what I would ask of our listeners. Write to us, webraptalk@gmail.com. The season's coming. Now, I know not all of you ride track days. Let us know what it is you look forward to doing. Are you going to be doing some big rides like multi-thousand mile or multi-hundred mile? Are you going to be doing track days? Are you going to be doing some sort of BDR off-roady stuff? Are you going to be doing some dirt biking stuff? Are you going to help someone learn how to ride a motorcycle? So let us know. The season's here. I'm really curious to see what's going on. We'll be busy with track days. Quentin's going to be busy with a lot of race stuff beyond track days. And so I'm going to be super excited to see what the rest of you are going to be doing. The next episode that we do after this, Q is going to be away. And I think we're going to invite one of our buddies who's really just one of my heroes in the motorcycle industry, our buddy Davin, who now works with Biltwell.
Oh, yeah. Good. Which I'm bummed because I want to be there, but at the same time, I think that'll be good. You need Davin to yourself.
Davin might pun more than you. It's wild.
Yeah, maybe.
Both of you have such brilliant minds. Right, just come up with the puns right on the. It's brilliant. I love it. So really excited for that. So hopefully we'll get him on and have a nice little conversation with him and talk to him about New Zealand and what he's doing with Biltwell and all of his awesome rides. And
he's a hog cranker. I'm actually kind of like
you're
I'm
definitely
a
hog cranker
hog
as well.
Cranking, I'm like, up like, in the hog cranking realm. Not quite David hog cranker,
you're
cranking
your
on my
like
hog. Let me tell you,
you're a pedigreed hog cranking fart.
Tonight when I went and got my tamales from my friend Sammy, I was like, Sammy, do you still have your hog? And she's like, yep, totally. I'm gonna chop it out this winter. I'm like, hey, look at what I work on. And I mean, nobody expects it. Nobody that knows me that doesn't like. She was like, whoa, right?
That bombshell, as Jeremy Clarkson used to say. I say safety third, make good choices. And Q, what do you say?
Don't sweat the petty things.
Good day. Faces I know, I fell in love with the people in my front
put me here and I'm all yours. Not for the money and it's not for the applause. No,
it's for the noise, please. Shack, shack, shack.